Karlsson, Karlsson, världens bästa Karlsson. Karlsson, Karlsson, hoj här kommer Karlsson. Karlsson, Karlsson, ingen faktiskt, ingen annan Karlsson spelar jag så bra som mig.
Karlsson, Karlsson, Karlsson scores!
Karlsson,
yes, welcome everybody to another episode of the Keeping Karlsson Fantasy Hockey Podcast, the best fantasy hockey podcast in the world, hosted by two guys who own Eric Karlsson in their keeper pools. I am your host, Elon Dubrovsky, and we've got a treat for you this week. I am talking Habs with one of the top beat writers in the game, Arpon Basu. It was a really fun chat. There were so many players I wanted to ask him about, and I really appreciate him giving us all the time he did to cover all of these Habs past, present, and future players. Before we get to that, let's of course mention that we are presented by DobberHockey.com, the top fantasy hockey website in the world. You definitely want to be checking that out every day to see all the creative articles they're coming up with, even in the pause. And of course, I use their tools at Frozen Tools. Maybe right now you're thinking, what do I need hockey stats for? But before you know it, maybe really soon that we're talking about fantasy hockey again, depending on what the NHL does. And so when you're doing your preps for your drafts or for whatever you're going to do, you want to check it out. So DobberHockey.com, FrozenTools.com, they've got the goods for you. But with that, I'm ready to cut over to my interview with Arpon Basu about the Montreal Canadiens. I know you're going to like it, so here it is. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of our Beat Interview Series. Really excited for the one I'm doing today because I have got the editor-in-chief of the Athletic Montreal, or the Athletique Montreal, depending on what language you speak, and my friend Michael's favorite Habs journalist, it's Arpon Basu. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm really excited to talk to you about the Montreal Canadiens. I was, you know, trying to think yesterday of what I should ask about them, and like a lot of questions came up, a lot of players who I'm excited about, and then a lot of players that I was like really disappointed in this year. So I'm going to be curious to get your thoughts on all of them. But I guess first let's talk about the team in general. The Habs like had a nice bounce back season in 2018-19. They had a good record, 44-30-8. They barely missed out on the final wildcard spot. And I'd imagine they were hoping to build on that in 2019-20. And I don't know if people remember, but things actually started out pretty well for the Habs. Like at one point in mid-November, they had a 5-2 win in Washington. And the Habs were riding a 3-game winning streak. At that point, they sat second in the Atlantic Division behind Boston. But that win versus Washington came at a big price. Jonathan Drouin, who was off to a great start, he suffered a wrist injury. Paul Byron hurt his knee. And the Habs then lost their next game against New Jersey. And that started an 8-game losing streak through November. And then they suffered another 8-game losing streak in January. And come the time of the NHL pause, the Habs sat with a losing record and another likely long playoffless summer on the horizon. Which may not be the case anymore. Yeah. I saw your article about the potential 24 team thing, but looked like it wasn't going to be a successful season for the Habs. Mm-hmm. What do you think went wrong with the Habs to cause them to take such a big step back this season? And like, do you think things would have gone differently if it wasn't for those injuries, or was this team like on track to have the wheels fall off regardless?
No, I don't think they were on track to have the wheels fall off, but they were. What they did need was basically a season of perfect health. And what the strong season that you mentioned last year, that's what happened. They basically had no significant injuries all season. So, you know, you saw kind of the best case scenario. I should mention that, you know, the season prior, Shea Weber missed the beginning of the season. So obviously that's significant, but they were able to weather that storm because they were playing such a good team game. And Claude Julien had implemented a system that was really working, this just high pressure system and just constant puck pressure and speed and relying on four lines to forecheck other teams into the ground. And it really was working. But they didn't have any other significant injuries. And this year, as soon as they had one or two, I should say, even though Paul Byron really wasn't playing that well at the time, he was pretty much a fourth line guy. So really one injury completely derailed the whole thing. So it just shows to what extent, you know, they have some good players and they have a good system. But you know, the defense is not that deep. And in order for them to be able to play that system, they need all their forwards to be available. Like they need all four lines to be fast and have some offensive skill on it, but mainly be fast and be able to forecheck and create turnovers and do those sorts of things. So as soon as Drouin went down and Byron went down, everyone had to be kicked up a notch in the lineup. They're starting filling with a parade of AHL guys that really are AHL players. And it just showed the lack of depth in their system, and it showed the lack of depth of talent on the team, that all it took was one really significant injury in Drouin. Byron is a significant guy, but he wasn't playing very well at the time. And it was like a house of cards that just kind of came down. So, you know, I think there are encouraging signs there for the Canes, in the sense that, you know, if they could build a team that could withstand those injuries, meaning, you know, with some of the prospects that they've drafted the last few years, and have guys in the AHL who have NHL futures, as opposed to being more basically AHL guys, that could help them. That could help them withstand those injuries, because they're inevitable and you're not going to go through a season without them. So, you know, that was kind of a lesson, in the sense that I think they just came back to earth, and just it was a realization that they just have more work to do to build more depth of talent. It's kind of a weird, I found it strange, because the strength of their team is their depth up front at forward, except once you get through those 12 guys, they don't have much depth behind them. So, So they're a team built on depth, but as soon as they lose like even a sliver of that depth, their lack of support depth, I guess, really exposes them. And that's what happened this year, because as soon as Drouin went out, everything just started to slowly fall apart.
Yeah. And I guess we'll get to some prospects that we can be excited about to enforce some of that depth. But actually, I'm curious to ask about Jonathan Drouin, because he's a player who I've been very curious about, because he is a guy who, you know, had this big pedigree, drafted third overall back in 2013. He's expected to be a blue chipper before things went sour in Tampa. And the Habs then gave up a blue chipper of their own in Mikhail Sergachev to acquire Drouin. And many of us thought Drouin would be like the centerpiece of the Canadiens offense. And while overall that clearly hasn't happened, Drouin has had a couple of really good strong starts to the past couple of seasons. Like in 2018-19, he was sitting at 46 points in 55 games, which is almost a 70-point pace in February. And then all of a sudden his minutes were slashed and he was relegated to the third line, and he sputtered the rest of the way, like 7 points in his final 26 games. And this past season, he was also again started hot, 15 points in his first 19 before this injury. And then when he came back for the 8 games, he only had no points, actually, only 7 shots. So I don't know. I guess that's a whole separate thing about an injury, but I'm having a hard time deciding, should we give up on Drouin or not? Since he has these stretches of looking fantastic, you seem to say, Arpan, that he's, you know, he was a big loss to the team, though it didn't look like he would have been a big loss when he was playing on the third line at the end of the last season. So what happened last year, and what is Drouin's role on the team at this point?
Well, I think, you know, the two starts are different. And here's why, because last year he was effective. You know, they acquired Max Domi. They took Drouin off center, where they had been playing him after acquiring him for Sergachev, which was a mistake from the get-go, and everyone knew it was. But they needed someone to play center. So then they went out and acquired Domi, who had been playing on the wing in Arizona. They acquired him for another player who they couldn't decide whether he was a winger or a center, in Alex Galchenyuk. So they acquired Domi and they moved him to center. And that allows Drouin to go to left wing and to play left wing with Domi, who's got some sort of similar attributes, in the sense that excellent puck handler, great vision, really good passer, great speed. And they seem to complement each other really well. And so, you know, Max Domi got off to a tremendous start last year with the Canes and had the best season of his career, 72 points. And Drouin was a big part of that for most of the season. Then Drouin just completely fell off a cliff. Like, I mean, his minutes fell because he became a completely ineffective player all of a sudden and could not produce anything. And so what happened was, and I think this is really, you know, we're not sure yet, but this might have been the epiphany in Jonathan Drouin's career, is that as he was going through the last third of that season, you know, he seemed to realize that maybe he's the problem. And to a certain extent, he always seemed to blame other things for why he wasn't producing. And at the end of last season, he came out, and there was a sea of reporters waiting for him, because he just had such a disastrous end to the season. And really, when the Canadiens needed him most, you know, they were trying to get into the playoffs and they could not count on this guy at all. And he had just completely lost all confidence, had lost all effectiveness. And essentially he didn't abandon the team, but basically did. I mean, his production abandoned the team at a time when they absolutely needed it the most. So he came out and he talked for 40 minutes about how he's going to find out what went wrong and he's going to fix it. And he's not going to allow this to happen again. And it was compelling stuff. And it took some courage to come out there and address it head on the way he did, especially coming from a guy who never did that. You know, he never took accountability for his own play and always found a reason for it or an excuse or what have you. So he really fell on his sword and handled it in a really mature way and a really smart way, really. And then he didn't just say that stuff. Then he, over the off season, he spent time, he talked to Dominique Ducharme, their assistant coach, but he also his coach with the Halifax Mooseheads back when he was in junior. And they spent time looking over video, and Ducharme identified problem areas in his game and what he should do differently. And he spent, you know, many, many days and many, many hours poring over video over the summer with Dominique Ducharme, and came to training camp the next year like a completely different player. Like it was night and day how he played the game. Like he was being, you know, instead of sort of looking for soft areas in the offensive zone and trying to get lost in the defense and looking for soft spots to spot up and get set up for a pass, you know, he was being assertive, and he made a point of constantly being around the puck. He was engaging in puck battles. He was winning puck battles. And he was just generally a more aggressive player and a more assertive player that was really making things happen almost every time he was on the ice. And the one point of emphasis he had was that he really emphasized that I want to make a positive contribution very early in every game. He wanted to get him. So his first two or three shifts in every game really jumped out at you because they were so different from what we had seen before, whereas, you know, he was generally a more like let the game come to me kind of guy before. And this year he started, you know, taking it to the game, you know, like making the game his. So, you know, but it only lasted till that game, November 15th, obviously, because he was injured. And when he came back, he wasn't healthy. Like he shouldn't have been playing really. And, you know, he tried to gut through it and it didn't really work. And there was no, it was kind of pointless. It was kind of stupid that he was playing because, for all intents and purposes, the Canadians were out at that point, but they just, you know, they refused to admit that to themselves. But if the player we saw up until November 15th is actually what Jonathan Drouin is now, then he might come close to fulfilling the potential that made him the number three pick in that draft. But we can't say that yet because the sample size is so small. But the Jonathan Drouin we saw from the beginning of October to November 15th was a very dynamic player, like a guy who could really help the Canadians and a guy who could really help who could really collect some points, because that was a really highly effective guy. But the question mark now is, how is this injury going to affect him? Because he was clearly affected by it when he came back. So is that going to affect him long term? And could this attitude adjustment wane at some point? Like, will this remain permanent? It's hard to know if that's the case.
It's very interesting, and it's good to hear that at the end of the season, it's not like he fell back to the old way. It's just he was playing hurt. Do you think, like, assuming he's healthy, can we, like, assume now Drouin's probably, like, the plan is for him to be a top sixer on the Habs, like, moving forward? Like, do you think he's, I guess you're saying that potentially if he comes back the same way he started this season, he might be able to finally break his career high?
They would love it. They would love it for that to happen. I mean, the organization, as you mentioned, traded a player who plays a position that now represents the organization's biggest hole. I mean, they need a top four left defenseman, like badly, like really badly. And so they could really use a Mikhail Sergachev on this team. But they decided, and, you know, I didn't disagree with it at the time. I'll be upfront about it. Mark Bergevin decided that it was okay to trade a prospect like that because they were getting a Jonathan Drouin who was 22. He was coming off, entry level. They were going to sign him to a long-term deal. They got him at a decent price at $5.5 million a year, so that if he did fulfill his potential, that would be a great bargain for them. It was a calculated risk, and I don't think it was such a bad risk, because the reality in Montreal, and people don't want to hear it, but it always helps when you have local kids, local Francophone kids playing for the Canadiens. When you have a good star player who can speak to their fans in French, it helps, and it definitely you know, makes Drouin a little tiny bit more valuable to the Canadiens than he would be to any other organization. So, is there hope? Yeah, there's hope. Cause the one thing I'll say is that it would strike me as odd for a player to make those realizations about themselves and get like a sort of certain degree of self-awareness and then just lose it.
Right.
Like generally you get more of that as you get older, as opposed to less. So, you know, it was a sign of maturity, and I think he's realized how fragile things are, and that NHL success is not going to be handed to him on a silver platter. And that's a big realization for a lot of junior stars to make. You know, for the number of times I heard Jonathan Drouin talk about what he did in junior as an NHL player, you know, you just wanted to kind of tell him and say, you're not in junior anymore. Like, that's not how it works, you know?
It's like an Al Bundy.
Yeah, exactly. So that finally dawned on him. And I would suggest that he's going to stick with that. Like, he's going to keep that mindset. So if he does, like the talent's there and no one's ever denied that, you know, but he's just got to keep that attitude and that edge and that feeling, I think, that this could all fall apart at any moment. You know, I think that's really what happened last year, is that he saw his own like NHL mortality to a certain extent, and he decided to do something about it rather than just accept it.
Yeah, it's really cool. And hey, maybe he'll be a good sleeper grab at the end of your fantasy draft. And you never know. Clearly the potential's there. On the other side, some players that have been surprising me, like in a positive way, I've got to talk about maybe the biggest bright spot. Well, there's a lot of bright spots that we'll get to, but like the top line for the Habs of Tatar, Gallagher, and Danault look really good. And like, I have to admit, like going into the season, I had an argument with my co-host Brian, like as he was saying that Gallagher, Danault, Tatar was like the first line. I was like, come on, no, like the Drouin, Domi line, that's the first line. Those are the real superstars on the team. But like, clearly this Danault center trio was the most successful, and the biggest breakout came from Thomas Tatar, who had like already broken his 58-point career high from 2018-19 before the pause. He was already at 61 points in 68 games. That's a 74-point pace. Yeah. And kind of like, you know, I just, in the last interview we did about the Islanders, we were talking about Brock Nelson, and I was telling Arthur Staple, like, I was surprised to see that Nelson did so well, and I wanted to look for reasons why he won't be able to do it again. And like, same with Tatar. Like, we've never seen Tatar do anything like this. So I was looking, and he didn't have an especially high shooting percentage. It's not as if he got like an exorbitant amount of his points on the power play. Like, everything looks like this was sustainable and for real. So do I just have to get with the times and expect 29-year-old Tatar to continue to be a 70-plus point guy next season as well?
I don't know about 70 plus point guy, but the one thing about Tatar is that he's a 20 something goal scorer. Like, he's a consistent 20 goal guy, like at like minimum, you know? And so like, I would think like Tatar is going to settle into a 25-35 guy, you know, like, so 60 points pretty consistently, like because his goal numbers dating back to Detroit. I mean, basically he had one bad year, and not even a bad year. He had two bad months with the Vegas Golden Knights after he got traded. A trade that happened because he lifted his no trade clause, because Kenny Holland got such a deal for him. I mean, they traded like four draft, like a first and 2 seconds. I don't remember what it was, but it was just a massive haul of draft picks that the Red Wings got for him. Tatar lifts his no trade, goes to Vegas. It doesn't work out at all. And he gets labeled as this like bust, you know, like, but it's like, even that year he scored 20 goals combined between the Red Wings and Vegas. Like, he's never not scored 20 goals in the season. So that's like, Tatar in that sense is money to me. Like, he will get you 20 goals. The other stuff comes as a result, I think, of, well, first, he's a hell of a player. Let's just get that out of the way. Like, he's a very, very good player. Is he an ideal top scorer? Like, is in an ideal world, is Thomas Tatar your most productive player? Probably not. You'd like him to be more of a secondary guy. But playing on that line with Danault and Gallagher, what it allows for him is you have Gallagher, who basically any line Gallagher will play on will win the possession battle that night for sure. So you could put him on the fourth line, and the fourth line will be a positive possession nine guaranteed. Just an incredible play driver, and his ability to control the wall and generate shots from in tight is really almost without equal. I mean, Brady Tkachuk's probably the closest comparable to him. Brady Tkachuk being, you know, a lot bigger than him, but they play a very similar game, and they have very similar results in terms of generating high danger shots. They're the two best in the league, actually. And so you have that. You have Phil Danault, who is starting to play his way into like certain Selke conversations. I don't know if he's ever going to win it, but I wouldn't be surprised if he got nominated one of these years. I mean, he's starting to generate some momentum in that sense. He's an incredible two-way player. And so what this does is it allows Tatar to have the puck in the offensive zone often. And he's a skilled guy in the offensive zone. He doesn't do anything at an elite level, but he does many, many things at a very, very high level. Like, he has a very good shot. He's very elusive. He has good mobility. He's able to stop and start very well. Carries the puck well, stick handles well, passes well, transitions well. Like, he does everything well. He doesn't do too many things badly. He doesn't do anything great, but he's good at a lot of different things. And I think that combination of having that guy with those two other guys who guarantee that he'll get a lot of puck time in the offensive zone has really made for kind of a happy marriage there. So, and plus on top of that, if you're talking from a fantasy perspective, he's going to be entering a contract here. And so that is, that's a consideration, I guess, because he's highly motivated to prove that he's worth another long-term contract.
Right, for sure. If he could put up another 70, even if you say like 60 plus point season, that really solidifies him. And do you think at this point, this top line of Danault, Tatar, and Gallagher, are they like super ingrained at this point as the top line on Montreal, like, you know, similar to like a Marchand, Bergeron, Pasternak on the Bruins? Or do you think that Julien would consider shaking things up? You know, it wasn't the most successful season.
Well, I mean, you're talking about Julien, who put that line together that you just mentioned before, right? The Marchand, Bergeron.
Oh, right.
You know, so like he's a coach who tends to lean on that anchor line, right? Like he did it in Boston for years, and he's done it. And once he found this combination, and it's really funny, like, you know, I'm convinced that the original combination was going to be Danault, Gallagher, and Pacioretty, because if you remember, Thomas Tatar was acquired with Nick Suzuki the day before the Canadiens open training camp last year. And so it wouldn't surprise me at all that Claude Julien and his coaching staff had spent like weeks coming up with their line combinations. And then all of a sudden you lose Pacioretty. They're like, oh, we'll just put Tatar there. We'll see how that works. And he basically never left that line. I mean, he left earlier this season. You know, he went through this stretch where he was taking a lot of really stupid penalties. So he got downgraded for a little bit, but basically that line stays together 90% of the time. Now, the only thing about that line is that not only is Tatar an unrestricted entering a contract year, all three of those guys are entering contract years. So they will all be UFA at the end of next season. So I think the only way that line gets broken up is if one of them gets moved, which is a possibility, because, you know, at center, you know, Phil Danault is an excellent two-way center, but are they going to want to pay him like a first-line center when they have a Nick Suzuki, they have a Jesperi Kotkaniemi that they're hoping will be playing in the top six? You know, I don't know if they, in an ideal world, the Canadians think of Philip Danault as their first line center when they're a winning team, hypothetically, right? So there's going to be a lot of decisions to make, because Brendan Gallagher's, you know, he's creeping towards 30. He'll be in his late 20s when his contract expires. He's going to want a very long term deal and deserves one. He's been underpaid he's one of the most underpaid players in the league. You know, his salary starts with a 3, so it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense for him. And so all three of those guys are going to be UFA. Phil Danault is going to want to be played probably like a Michael Backlund, somewhere in that range. So something starting with a 5. And Tatar is going to want something probably starting with a 6. So between the three of them, and Gallagher could get something starting with a 7. So you got 7 and 5, 12, and 6 is 18. So you'd be going from a line that's, you know, that's pretty affordable to a line that's suddenly pretty expensive. And if you want that line to eventually move down the depth chart as prospects start coming in, the Canadiens are going to need to make some decisions there. So, yeah, I mean, I would say that line is pretty cemented for now, but something's going to have to give at some point. And so we're going to see once the offseason comes, whenever that is, how many of those guys get contract extensions, what this whole situation means for their contract situation. So there's a lot of balls up in the air on that line, but for now, for sure. And I think in Claude Julien's mind, because that's not Claude Julien's problem, but in Claude Julien's mind, that's his top line.
Right. So this is an ingrained line, and maybe Julien has to write like the last dance on the blackboard or something, because like, these three guys might all be gone.
Yeah. Like, Julien might be gone for all he knows. I mean, who knows? There might be a lot of people gone. Yeah. If they don't make the playoffs next year, there's going to be a lot of changes here, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, one player that should help with that, and it's surprising, a guy you didn't even mention when listing all these centers, is Max Domi, who's a pending restricted free agent. And he's a guy who just 2 seasons ago, he was the guy on the Habs that was breaking 70 points, like you said. And yeah, that season he had a bit of a high shooting percentage compared to his career average in Arizona. But like, Brian and I definitely didn't predict that Domi would fall as far as he did this season. Like, at the time of the pause, Domi only had 44 points in 71 games. That's like a 51 point pace, basically back to his Arizona numbers. I read this article that you wrote on The Athletic, very interesting, about how Domi was jumping around the lineup, and like, he started centering Drouin and Armia for much of the time before Drouin got injured, and then he went to the wing, and like, he wants to be center. But at the same time, like you said, like, they've got Danault potentially, like Suzuki, Kotkaniemi. So what is the plan for Domi and his future in Montreal, I guess? So yeah, in terms of his position. And also, I'm curious, like, do you think that 70 plus point season was kind of like a fluke, and this 50 point Domi is more of the real version?
No, I don't think it was a fluke. I think, you know, the context of that 70, yeah, his shooting percentage was high. And at one point it was through the roof. Like, it was in the high 20s, you know? And so it slowly started to regress as the season went along, and later in the season he was scoring less often, but still a highly effective player. And the difference the season before, he was playing with, with really good line mates. And this year, he, because of the injuries and everything that happened, he just never had a consistent set of line mates.
Right.
Still had a decent season, honestly. Like, people kind of harped on his point total, and they should. It wasn't as high as the season before, but still pretty good year. Like, pretty much better than all his years in Arizona. I mean, you know, not that much better, but still better. And doing this without any real consistent line mates and even real quality line mates. I mean, frankly, as far as offensive players go, he didn't really have a chance to play with too many finishers. So the thing with Domi is, when you have Domi and Drouin on your team, it's hard not to get the sense that they're very similar players, and that maybe one makes the other somewhat redundant, or if you're trying to fill a hole somewhere else in your lineup, you can use one of them to do that because you have the other one. Drouin is signed long-term at a decent price. It's a bit of an overpay right now, but I still think he could play himself into making that a decent contract at 5.5 a year. Domi's not signed. No one is quite clear what his intentions are in terms of what kind of contract he's looking for. And this whole position thing is just weird because Domi knows very well that they have all these centers coming up. And he seems really insistent on wanting to play that position. And frankly, I don't think they have room for him at that position anymore. So either he, because the times he did switch to wing, he clearly didn't like it, was clearly ineffective, and made it obvious they didn't like it. So if he wants to play center, it's doubtful if he's going to get to do it in Montreal. So again, they're going to have to make a decision on him, but they're going to have to make the decision really soon. The good thing is that they could sign him to a one-year contract. They could even take him to arbitration if they want and get him on a one-year contract and then trade him. And give another team a chance to decide if they want to sign him long term or whatever, or they could keep him for that year. And because they could still play him at center now, it's not a problem. It's just down the road when Kotkaniemi's like 21, 22, and Suzuki's 23, 24. Like, you'd want those guys to be your top two centers. So, you know, they're going to have to make a decision here, and I'm not quite sure which way they're going to go. But he is easily, you know, among the players that the Canadians might be willing to trade, he would be the one I would think that would bring back the best return, because he has a very unique package. You can't not discuss his feistiness and just his ability to agitate and to play physical and fight on occasion and just play that role as well. Would be appealing to teams, and I would love to see him play in the playoffs. He's never played a playoff game. So that's kind of the one benefit of this 2014 play-in playoff situation they're kind of talking about, is we'd get to see Max Domi in a playoff environment. I personally think he would thrive in it. Like, he just seems to me like the type of guy who would be really good at it. But we can't know that until we see it. So the Canadians have a lot of question marks, I think, on him. And they're going to have to make a decision on him, most likely without those questions necessarily being answered.
Yeah, it would be, like you say, it would be interesting to see what he can do with another full season of playing with strong line mates like Drouin or someone else. It is a really good point. It maybe makes him someone that could be a little underrated going into next year. I guess if they do trade him, it's not, you know, with Drouin, like you say, they gave up a defenseman who could have been like a cornerstone for them. With Domi, they gave up Galchenyuk, who's not even working out so well anyway. So who cares if it doesn't work out?
But the irony is that they could flip Domi for a guy who would replace Sergachev. Like, that's what they, like, right now, Domi's the best avenue to getting that defenseman, that top forward left shot defenseman. Max Domi's the player that would be the most realistic path to getting one on the trade market that's effective. Mm-hmm. You know, a guy like a Jonas Brodin, or there's various guys around the league who might become available. Brodin's just the one that always pops up because the Wild, for some reason, seem to want to trade him. But you know, you're not going to get a Jonas Brodin for even a Jonathan Drouin at this point. I think Max Domi's has more trade value than Drouin at this point.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense until Drouin puts together a full good season.
Yeah.
So you brought up Nick Suzuki before, and I'd love to talk about him now, like a huge positive from this season. Got to imagine the organization is excited about what they got in exchange for Pacioretty, getting Suzuki and Tatar, and especially after this rookie season for Nick Suzuki as a 20-year-old. He started a bit slow. He finished on a bit of a slump, but overall still ended with a solid 41 points in 71 games. That's a 47-point pace. And just for fun, I did some math here. Take away his first six games. He's like getting used to the league, okay? He only had one assist in those six games. Take away the final nine games, because, I don't know, things got weird there at the end. If you take out those two stretches and just look at the middle of the season, he had a stretch of 55 games where he put up 39 points. So he was a 58-point pace player for a good chunk of the season as a 20-year-old.
And, you know, you can add to that, like, he began the season on the wing, and then he only really permanently moved to center in, I want to say, January. So it took him a while. Like, he played on the wing with Nate Thompson on the fourth line for forever.
Right.
Then he was Domi's winger. And then I remember, actually, my story the night Drouin and Byron got hurt, my story was, is it time for Nick Suzuki to take over for Max Domi at center? Because they needed someone to replace Drouin on left wing. So I'm like, this is a perfect chance to just shift Domi to the left wing and put Suzuki at center. It didn't happen for another 2 months or 6 weeks or so. But still, once he was moved to center and was made somewhat permanent there, his effectiveness went through the roof. Like, he just became a much, much more effective player. So, like, it would be interesting. I haven't actually looked at the numbers, but it would be interesting to see what his production at the center position. And I would imagine it would be even better than a 58-point pace player, because he was just a dynamic player every single night for a stretch of like 5 weeks. And it was really impressive to watch. So next year, there will be no question of when he comes into training camp that he is a center. He'll be a top six center, and he will be given appropriate wingers to play with, and will play with them from beginning to end. And I really think you're going to see a really productive Nick Suzuki next year because of that. He's going to have stability. This season, he produced in an environment of total instability. Like, he wasn't supposed to make the team. He forced his way onto the team. He wasn't really supposed to move up the lineup. He forced his way up the lineup. Was probably their best power play player, honestly. So I think his numbers this year, you know, I don't see him going into a sophomore slump. I might regret those words, but I mean, I don't see him being the type of guy who would do that. I just see him growing, because I think he'll be in a very, very stable situation. Like, unless he plays his way out of it, and I just don't see that happening either, but it's, you know, anything's possible. I couldn't have seen Jesperi Kotkaniemi having the season he had this year either when he had a great rookie year last year. But there's just something different about this guy. He's got a maturity to him, not only to his game, but just generally speaking as a guy. And is just such a great decision maker on the ice that he doesn't get himself in trouble too often. And I really think that in a stable situation where he's playing center and has high skill guys next to him, he's going to produce. I really think so.
Wow, so the best is clearly yet to come. And you're saying as soon as next season, he's going to blow that 58-point pace stretch like out of the water. Do you think we can expect some more shots on goal as he gets like more comfortable in the league? That was the one, I guess, downside. I saw only fewer than two shots per game on average. But generally, players shoot more as they advance from their rookie season.
Yeah, I think so. He's not a guy who – a lot of young players, a lot of rookies will pass by default and will sort of over-defer to the veterans. And he did that a little bit when he was playing with Kovalchuk. Like, the that little span of time he played with Kovalchuk, he was looking for him a little bit too much. He was kind of in awe. we were all kind of in awe of the fact that Ilya Kovalchuk was on the, like, you know, even me as a reporter, I was like, this is really cool. This is Ilya Kovalchuk. Like,
and he was doing really well for that stretch.
He was doing really well, and it was just fun talking to him. Like, I just found it fun having such an accomplished player in the room all of a sudden for that short stretch that he was there. But Nick Suzuki was playing with him. And not only was he playing with him, but Kovalchuk, like, every day he would talk about Nick Suzuki. He'd be like, oh, and Susie, he's so good. And he was just so impressed with the kid. But it took him a while to figure out that he doesn't have to just kill Kovalchuk the puck all the time. You know, like, he can make plays himself. And that's natural. That's a rookie kind of. So, yeah, I think the shots on goal will go up as he feels more comfortable as an NHL player and not just this kid who forced his way into the NHL and wants to keep all the veterans happy. Like, that wears off. His shot is top five on the team, I would say, among forwards. He's got one of the five best shots among forwards on the team. So for him not to shoot it would be ridiculous. I'm sure the coaching staff was already telling him you need to shoot the puck more. It's just a matter of time before he starts actually doing it.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And yeah, it makes him really excited moving forward. I guess on the other side, you brought up Kotkaniemi, who's the other third overall pick on the team. And Kotkaniemi looks super young, not even 20 yet, and now has a couple seasons of NHL experience under his belt, or maybe more like 1.5 seasons, because he got that first full rookie season. And then this season, 19-20, he was only seeing around 13 minutes of time on ice and only had 8 points through 36 games, ended up getting sent down to AHL Laval. And I'd imagine like the goal of the demotion was, you know, get him more ice time, help him build his confidence. And he looked good, right? He had 13 points in 13 games in the AHL, was playing on the top line. Unfortunately, his season got cut short before the pause. He suffered a splenic injury in early March, I read. So like, first off, how is Kotkaniemi health-wise? Is he looking like on track to be back to 100%, you know, next season? And do you think that a big step forward is coming soon now that he's no longer a teenager? And also, like, I mean, to ask more questions, like, where does he even have room in the lineup? Like, I don't even understand how he could take a step forward if he's behind Dano and Suzuki and Domi.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing about Domi, right? I mean, are you going to leave Domi there just to make Domi happy, even if that means keeping Kotkaniemi and Laval as a result? Like, that's a question the Canadians have to ask themselves, right? If they could legitimately feel, and they wouldn't necessarily be wrong, that maybe Kotkaniemi having a full season in Laval would be the best thing for him. Maybe. I don't know. I don't think so, but perhaps. But that's kind of what they would have to do if they decide to keep Domi around. Like, that's really why the Domi situation is so delicate, because Kotkaniemi probably would be best served being the third line center on this team. You know, to answer your earlier questions, he is healthy in the sense that he's been cleared to work out. He won't be cleared for contact for quite some time, I've been told. You know, the Canadians are being very, very Canadian-y about it, but basically, you know, it's like a typical spleen injury. You know, a spleen injury comes from, he got injured when he was hit into the boards somewhat from behind. It wasn't a dirty hit, and it wasn't even all that malicious. It didn't even look all that bad, but the door was like just slightly ajar when he got hit into it. So the sort of the edge of the boards went into him. It was sort of like a blunt force trauma in a way, and injured his spleen. And so a spleen injury, you know, luckily it didn't rupture and it didn't require surgery. So that was the good news. And then a spleen injury just needs rest. Like, it basically needs rest to properly heal and properly be prepared to withstand potentially another blow. And if you don't wait that long, then if you do suffer another blow, then it could rupture and then you have a serious problem on your hands. So he won't be cleared for contact anytime soon, but he should be cleared for contact by the time next season begins. Like, I don't think he would be cleared to play if indeed the season resumes this summer. I don't think he would be involved in that. But, you know, he's back home in Finland, so he was given the green light to leave here, is working out there, and it'll be up to him, basically. I mean, if he comes to training camp and shows that he's ready to play in Montreal, then they're going to have to make some decisions again. And frankly, I just don't see how they don't move Domi to the wing to make room for him, because that would be the smartest thing. That would be the way to make, you know, the lineup with the most talent. That would be it, because Kotkaniemi's a talented player. He's really a very good player. He just had a really, really hard luck season. Like, he was injured at toward the tail end of training. He had a bad training camp, which is on him. Towards the tail end of that camp, he got hurt, played through the injury for a month. They shut him down. He comes back. He gets concussed on a nasty hit by Nikita Zadorov, misses a bunch of time for that, comes back, never really gets his rhythm, gets sent down to Laval. He's playing great in Laval, is loving life, is getting ice time. He's enjoying the sort of the more hands-on coaching he was getting and more the one-on-one sort of individual instruction, and was really enjoying it, sincerely. Like, was really sincere about how much he was liking the environment there. And then the spleen injury happened. So, you know, chalk it up. He'd never really gone through a season like that. So you can chalk it up to a learning experience, but it's going to be interesting to see what kind of player we see in training camp. But I would imagine by that point, we're going to see a much bigger kid. You know, it's going to be a stronger kid who has filled out a little bit. You know, his 20th birthday is in July. So, you know, he's got some growing to do. So we'll see.
Yeah, which is wild to say about someone who had his rookie season already 2 years ago, but very cool. Yeah, I remember I saw a stat that he was, when he played his first game in 2018-19, he was like the youngest player in all of professional sports, of like the four major sports.
No, he was the first, player in all four professional sports, North American professional sports. He was the first player born in the 2000s to take part in a game. Yeah.
That's wild.
So he was the first player ever to take part from the 2000s, from the four sports to take part in a game.
That's wild. I'm glad to hear that you're like not discouraged about him because of this rough season. It's funny when you said very Canadiansy about how they were handling the Kotkaniemi injury right away. It obviously reminded me of Shea Weber, who had that injury.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Where we had like no idea if he was ever going to come back. And they were very Canadiansy about Shea Weber this season at one point, where they were like saying he might be injured and might like retire. And the next thing you knew, he was like back later that week.
Okay. To be fair, the Canadians never said he might not retire. Like the Canadians never said he might retire. What was going on is that the Canadians created an environment where it was going to be reported that he might, like, so this is what happened. So Shea Weber hurt his ankle. Anyhow, I think he hurt his ankle. And so he gets injured regardless. And the Canadians don't say anything about the injury. And it's very, very nebulous. They're not answering, closed, not answering questions about it. And so, you know, obviously when this happens, people start digging. And so, you know, Bob McKenzie one day tweeted out that that Shea Weber's injury is of greater concern than the Canadians are letting on, that there could be some long-term implications to this. And then a couple of days later, Nick Kyprios comes out and flat out says that Shea Weber might wind up retiring. So this kind of forced the Canadians into action and to kind of respond and be like, okay, this is what's going on. And then the next thing you know, I think like 4 days later, Shea Weber was at practice.
Yeah.
It was just bizarre, and if the Canadians had just been like the least bit transparent about it, which they had no reason not to be, we find out through like Darren Dreger that Shea Weber has gone to see the foot specialist that had worked on his foot the last time it got hurt when he had a problem with a broken foot, went to see him to consult with him to see if it was the same thing. He told him it's not the same thing. So then the timeline became very different because their concern was that this injury was related to the previous injury, the one that the Canadians themselves had misdiagnosed for months, and that this guy in Wisconsin, he's like a world-renowned foot doctor in Wisconsin. His name just escapes me right now, but he's in Green Bay and does tons of work with the NBA players, NFL players. He performed the surgery on that foot injury, one that the Canadians completely missed. So I think, you know, Shea Weber wouldn't come out and say it, but considering how it went the last time, I can't really blame him for wanting to go to that doctor again just to make sure that everything was okay. And once he did that, and the doctor was like, hey, this is just like an ankle injury, you can just treat it like an ankle injury, it has nothing to do with the other one, then all of a sudden, Shea Weber was like, oh, if it's just an ankle injury, I'll just play on it. Like, no problem. So then it was out of the Canadians' hands. Then it was just Shea Weber saying, well, I'm going to play. That's all there is to it. So that was, that's a very Canadiansy thing as well, but yeah.
It's good to finally get the backstory there. By the way, I Googled it. Dr. Robert Anderson. We got to give him his due.
Yes, that's him. Yeah, absolutely. He's apparently very, very good. And Shea has spoken quite glowingly about him and how well he did it. And really, frankly, he saved him because the Canadians had no clue what the hell was going on with his foot. And again, in their defense, it took someone like this guy, like this Dr. Robert Anderson. It took someone of his degree of specialty to identify the problem. So, I think that injury kind of humbled the Canadians in the sense that they didn't really know how to deal with it, which was a very rare rare type of fracture in that area of the foot, where there's a lot of ankle tendons and there's a whole sorts of things going on. But yeah, the Canadians didn't really handle that all that well. But in any case, you know, I think Shea Weber is perfectly healthy and had a hell of a season, frankly. I thought his play was really encouraging this year.
Yeah, I want to ask you about it, though, because I did a podcast, I guess, a couple months ago now, when the pause first happened, where I split all of the stats for the season into first half and second half and in a spreadsheet. And then I highlighted the players who, like, green for players who did a lot better in the second half, and then red for players who were, like, a lot worse in the second half. And Shea Weber stood out big time as a red boy, as we called him. He had 28 points in his first 34 games and then disappeared 8 points in his final 31 games. So I was kind of hoping you'd come on and say, oh, that was the injury, and you could just blame it all on that.
No.
It's just like, what happened there?
Well, the whole team collapsed, right? I mean, right. Basically, like, it's that's a product of the team. Like, don't get me wrong, Shea Weber did not play well during that stretch. He had a long stretch of games where he was very ineffective, and contributed to the Canadians losing a lot of games. Like, basically, from that November 15th game on, I mean, you look at their record from that point onward, it's awful. Like, they were 11-5-3 on November 15th, and they finished, what, 28, 29 and something? I don't know. They finished just below 500. Yeah, they had a losing record. So their record from November 15th onward is terrible. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of a product of that, you know? Like, on November 15th, the Canadians led the league in 5-on-5 goals.
Yeah, and Weber was among the top, like, defensemen in the league at this point.
He was top defenseman, and he was top three, I think, in scoring among defensemen. And he was just looked like a total rejuvenated player, and it was fitting a narrative because it was the first year that he had a full offseason to train since that injury that we were talking about before, the original injury with Dr. Robert Anderson. So this was the first full offseason he had to prepare for a season, and it looked great. But when things went south for the Canadians, like, there's all sorts of reasons to explain that disparity. You know, Carey Price's play was erratic, but you could say that Carey Price's play was erratic because of Shea Weber and because of Ben Chiarot and because of a few other factors. But the fact is that, you know, the Canadians, you know, Shea Weber is not a player. I don't think he ever was a player that could, you know, single-handedly right the ship of a sinking ship, you know? And so as the Canadians started to drop, Weber started to drop in terms of production and everything. And even his goals against numbers were very, very bad. I mean, from November 15th on, him and Chiarot were just bleeding goals left, right, and center. So so there's still a question mark there. But, you know, overall, considering where we were coming from with his injury history, considering that there was a report that he might retire during the season, yeah. I'd say that overall his season was a pretty positive one, more so than a negative one.
Right. And so do you think it's possible that next season we see another first half 2019-20 Shea Weber show up? Like, could he be like one of the, like, a big surprise top scoring defenseman, say top five defenseman? Do you think those years are past him? Like, he's too old, too weathered to like have a full consistent season being that offensive.
My hope is that the Canadians will soon realize that Shea Weber himself will soon realize that he and his team and everyone involved would be best served if he just took less minutes. And so if they played him as a second pairing defenseman, I think he would be more productive. I think if they picked his spots with him, if he didn't always go out for every defensive zone draw, and just tried to, you know, if they just started to manage him a little better and be realistic about the fact that he's aging and that his body's going to need to get used to a different set of circumstances, I don't see why he couldn't be a very productive player. The problem is that when you play him into the ground and you play him 25, 26 minutes on back-to-backs against the top lines, every shift, D-zone draw, every high leverage situation Shea Weber is out there, and you have Jeff Petrie sitting there waiting to take some of those minutes on, mm-hmm. I don't see why they wouldn't either find, you know, this year I think they found more of an equitable share between the two, but if I were them, I would just start giving a lot of those minutes to Jeff Petrie and sort of live with it, because Jeff Petrie has his own issues when it comes to, you know, turnovers or just somewhat less than inspired play in his own end at times. But I think on the whole, he's a guy who could take on more of that responsibility and take some of it away from Shea Weber. And I think the Canes would wind up with a far better player. The problem is that neither Shea Weber nor the Canadians are willing to admit that that's the best course of action. And that's so even if the Canadians wanted to do that, I don't think Shea Weber would let them. It's like he would just jump over the boards and go on the ice. So,
right.
But I think, to answer the question, I think he could be a very productive player still. The shot is still there and it still beats goalies unscreened. He's one of the only players in the league who can beat an NHL goalie with a slap shot with no one standing in front of the goalie. That has value. But, you know, in order to get into the spots where he can get those shots off, you know, I think a little reduction in his minutes might actually lead to more of those opportunities, ironically.
Yeah, your colleague at The Athletic, Sean Shapiro, we were talking about Dallas, and he said a very similar thing about Jamie Benn, like saying he thinks Benn would be really good if he only played, like, you know, fewer right. minutes, because again, like someone older, that's yeah, plays a tough game.
Yeah. Older, plays a tough game, big body, a lot of miles on it. You know, I mean, it's not a bad comparison, actually. And it's funny, because when Shea Weber was in Nashville, he and Jamie Benn had some, like, epic battles. Like, just I watched some video. I did a feature on Weber early last year, and I talked to Jamie Benn about him. And it was crazy, like how with what kind of reverence he talked about Shea Weber. And then I went back and looked at some of their matchups and saw some video, like vicious games, man. Like, honestly, like just nasty stuff between these two guys. But like both of them, like with huge smiles on their faces, you know, like they're both BC boys. They like that stuff. But yeah, it's not a terrible comparison, even though they play different positions. But, you know, the wear and tear that they've taken on so far, you know, a step back could lead to two step forwards for both those guys.
Yeah. Well, maybe if one of them takes the first step, the other one can follow along. But you brought up Jeff Petrie. I wanted to ask about him. He really kind of came out of nowhere. Like when Shea Weber got injured back, you know, in 2017-18, and then again in 2018-19, it was Jeff Petrie who stepped up big time. Like he had never been more, like when he had his 28 points in 16-17, that was his career high with Montreal. And then all of a sudden, Weber goes down. And next thing we see, Jeff Petrie is like a 40-plus point defenseman. And even this season, when Weber was healthy and in the line, well, we don't know, he was in the lineup anyways, but Petrie again had a 46-point pace going into the pause. So like, first of all, like, do you have an explanation for like how Petrie went his whole career under the radar like he did before this breakout over the past three seasons? And then like, should we expect this to continue, especially if we're expecting or hoping that Weber maybe takes a decreased role at some point?
Well, I don't know. I mean, all I'll say is that since that first season you were at 2016-17, was it? I mean, he's set a new career high in each of the last four seasons, and he was on pace to do it again this season. So it was, you know, he's talked about his time in Edmonton. Like Edmonton never trusted him in his own end. They saw him as a soft player who wasn't physical enough for a guy that's that size. They thought he should be a little bit more tough to play against, quote unquote. But, you know, I mean, incredible skater, high-end offensive instincts, and just really smart offensively and smart in transition. Yes, on occasion he has a screw up in his own end or a screw up in the neutral zone that leads to an odd man rush. He does do that from time to time. But if you look at the body of work as a whole, you know, the positives far outweigh the negatives in his game. And you know, he's another guy who's entering a contract here. You know, they have their entire top line, Jeff Petrie and Armia and are all UFA. Yeah, well, those five are UFAs and Domi's an RFA this year. And those five guys are UFAs in 2021. So, you know, they're going to have to make a decision. But I mean, Jeff Petrie has just, I think, year after year shown, given no indication that he's slowing down. He's getting up in years. He's starting to head toward his mid-30s. But I think, you know, the Canadians giving him one more contract would make a whole lot of sense because he really enjoys playing here. He's a really effective player. And, you know, age or not, I just don't see how they would replace him. Like, he's one of the most irreplaceable players on the team because there's no real pipeline of right side D coming. You know, I mean, Cale Fleury's there. They have a couple of guys, you know, Noah Jules, they have a few options, but I wouldn't bet against Jeff Petrie breaking his career record again.
Oh, wow. So maybe he'll hit 50.
Maybe he'll fit. I don't know. He could. Because every year I think he's not going to do it, and then he does. So I'm tired of betting against him. So I would say, you know, but, you know, I think mid-40s is a pretty reasonable expectation for him. Like, it wouldn't be unreasonable for him to repeat what he did this year.
Well, that's great to hear. And, like, good for him to have, you know, this bounce, or I don't know what you'd call it, like, not bounce back, but, like, you know, a new life, new lease on life when he finally got to Montreal. I you've given me so much good content here, and I'm looking at the time go by, and I have to get to the goaltending here, because time's been flying. I want to talk about Carey Price for sure. It's not long ago that we were looking at him as the clear, like, best goalie in the world. That's the phrase that's been thrown around about him. Best athlete in the world, my friend Michael, who I referenced before, would call him. Those amazing seasons. He had, like, a bunch of seasons in a row in the mid-2010s where he was putting up, like, 925, 932. Like, his save percentages were otherworldly. But then, like, things really fell off for Price in an injury-riddled 2017-18 season. And then in 2018-19, he looked better, like not as good as his prime years, but he had a strong second half, ended with a 918 save percentage. But then this season, he was back below 910 and 909 save percentage in 58 games. But of course, the big question to me is like, how much of Price looking human in these past few seasons is his fault versus like the fault of the Habs, which I think you brought up, and just like not having strong defense? Because it's, I'd imagine it's not a coincidence that he started to fall off right after Andre Markov left the team.
Yeah.
So like, is Price still amazing and he's just in a bad situation? If he was on Boston, he'd be doing better than Tuukka Rask?
Oh, you see, like that's an interesting question. Because if you're saying, is Price still amazing, but he's just on a bad team? I would say, no, he's not amazing. He's still very good. But is the play in front of him impacting his results? For sure. But he goes through each of the last 2 years, he's gone through a stretch in November where he's just flat out bad. And I don't think anyone could deny that he had a bad month of November this year and he had a bad month of November last year. And they fell at the same time and they kind of derailed. The last year it didn't derail the season because the Canadiens were able to outscore sort of his mistakes. This year, it really kind of helped derail the season. Like right when they needed Price to kind of carry them for a bit, when Julian Byron got hurt in that game, that's when his game went south,
right.
And it really, really hurt the team. But the Bruins question is fascinating because, you know what? I think he could, but not for the reason you think. Like I think he would be as good, if not better, than Tuukka Rask in Boston because Tuukka Rask has Yaroslav Halak, and that's what Carey Price needs in Montreal. He needs, obviously not Yaroslav Halak because that would just be too weird. But he needs his own Halak. He needs a guy who can play 30, 35 games and be credible and have the confidence of his teammates and be a real viable option as a number two, which has been really the biggest failing of the last 3 years for Marc Bergevin. No, maybe last 2 years for Marc Bergevin has been his inability to find an adequate backup goalie for them. You know, Antti Niemi gets really salvaged off the trash heap 2 years ago or 3 years ago, finds his game in Montreal, has his old goalie coach Stefan Waite from his Chicago days, and looks really good. And the Canadiens take like a few good months and say, okay, well, this must be our guy. And they sign him to be the backup again, has a terrible season, is probably the biggest reason the Canadiens did not make the playoffs last year was Antti Niemi. And not Antti Niemi, it was the fact that Marc Bergevin didn't get them a better backup than Antti Niemi. Because I think Carey started 20 out of 21 games, I want to say, like in February and March last year. And, you know, it was only when it became clear they weren't making the playoffs that he sat. And this year, same deal. He played every game. He played in back-to-backs. And it wasn't until they were practically mathematically eliminated that he finally sat down. And so, you know, the Tuukka Rask mention is uncanny because, you know, I know you were asking because if Price plays behind the Bruins, would he be better than Tuukka Rask? I don't know. I think Tuukka Rask's a damn good goalie. They're probably roughly equal in terms of talent and effectiveness. But would Carey Price be way better with a backup goalie like Tuukka Rask has? I would really think so. And the unfortunate thing is that we don't know because the Canadiens have never provided him with that.
Right.
So I think it's truly a priority this year for them to get a really competent backup goalie. And I think they're actually willing to pay for it. Because the big problem with Carey Price is that his contract is so massive. The Canadiens have a hard time stomaching paying his backup a lot of money as well. So they put like a budgetary limit on that position, almost on principle. Like it's almost like, well, we're paying him so much, we can't pay his backup $3.5 million if we're paying him $10.5 million. So, but I think they've realized the error of their ways. Like they're not getting the most out of that $10.5 million investment because they're not spending money on his backup. And, you know, we wrote a piece earlier this season, like earlier this during this pause, where we compared it to, basically, we compared it to buying a Ferrari, but using regular unleaded gas and using replacement parts and not replacing the tires when you're supposed to and not driving it around all winter. You know, like it's basically what they're doing to Carey Price. So not that Carey Price, I think, should take some responsibility for his play, but the Canadiens have not helped him nearly as much as they should have.
Yeah, it makes sense. I remember this past season, whenever Keith Kincaid got a start, it like felt a guaranteed loss day. Like, go play daily fantasy and like bet on all the players that are playing against the Habs that day.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It was just so predictable too. And the thing is, you know, like, and the Canadiens were so close to having Curtis McElhinney, and you know, not that Curtis McElhinney is this godsend of a backup, but far more competent backup than him. Yeah, solid. And you know, the hill the Canadiens died on there was that they didn't want to give him a second year. So, frankly, the Canadiens were really close to signing him, and then Tampa swooped in at the last minute and offered the second year, so we went with them. But it was really, it really came down to that. And look at, like, this would have been the second year of the deal, and the Canadiens are in the market for a backup goalie again.
Yeah, so it's like, what was the point?
Yeah, exactly.
They signed a guy, Vasily Demchenko, out of the KHL recently, and they have this 20-year-old Caden Primo in the system who's been playing with Laval the past season, had a .908 save percentage. Is it, like, do you think one of these guys is going to, or like, is one of these guys in the plans, or do you think it's like they are going to go, it sounds like you're saying they're going to go find someone else in free agency to be the backup goalie?
Oh, I think they're going to find someone else. Like they, if they enter training camp with the two guys you just mentioned and Charlie Lindgren, who's also in the picture, if they enter training camp with some sort of battle between those three guys for the job, like, it would just be like, you know, it would be the epitome of insanity, where insanity is repeating the same thing and expecting a different result, right? It's like, it's so the goalie market is so flush this summer with backup options. They have money to spend on a 1-year deal. Now I just mentioned all the UFAs they have on their team, so they don't. So now it actually does make sense to stick to a 1-year deal because they might not have the money next year, but they have it this year, so they could overpay for a backup if they want. If they want to give Robin Lehner $5 million a year, they could do it.
Oh, that'd be huge.
You know, like, I don't think they will, but they could.
I don't think Lehner would like that. He wants to finally be a starter.
Yeah, I don't think Lehner would like that either. But I'm just like, you know, all those guys, they have so many guys to choose from. Like, if Anton Hudobin feels like playing a year behind Carey Price and getting a lot of minutes and you know, I don't know, experiencing playing in Montreal or whatever, you know, there's goalies that could be available on the trade market, Antti Raanta in Arizona. I'm sure that they wouldn't mind cutting ties with him. They are suddenly a cap team, and he takes up a lot of their cap. So there's a situation there that maybe the Canadiens could take advantage of. Jake Allen in St. Louis, who played his junior hockey in Montreal. I mean, there might be an opportunity there. So there's a lot of ways for the Canadiens to go here. But the one thing they can't do is just sit back and let the situation solve itself, because everything that they've tried hasn't worked, and they're like basically wasting their money on Carey Price as long as they don't solve this situation.
Yeah, definitely makes sense. Hopefully they get someone good. Okay, one other prospect I want to bring up. We got a lot of listeners who love the prospect talk, and we got to talk about the 2019 15th overall pick, Cole Caulfield. He spent this past season playing for the University of Wisconsin of the NCAA, and he led his team in scoring with 19 goals, 36 points in 36 games, ahead of another prospect we talked about with Lisa Dillman about the Kings, Alex Turcotte. So he's better. There you go. Lock it in. Better than Alex Turcotte already. So yeah, got to imagine the Habs are happy with what they saw out of Caulfield this past season. Do you think he gets a shot with the big club in 2021, or are we expecting at least another year in the minors first?
It's hard to say. I don't know. I think there's a reasonable expectation. You know, he didn't come out and say it, and the Canadiens haven't come out and said it, but I would be stunned if he didn't finish next season in Montreal. Like, that's really what I see happening, depending on how next season plays out. If University of Wisconsin even has a season, and whenever the next season starts, I mean, who knows if the NCAA doesn't get back up and running in time, and the NHL doesn't start until December. I mean, I don't know. It's not inconceivable to me that he could just sign a contract and start next season in Montreal, but it's, you know, the Canadiens did want him, and not only the Canadiens, his own coach, his own dad. I mean, there's all sorts of people around him really were encouraging him to go back to the University of Wisconsin for a second year. You know, but you see your buddy Alex Turcotte sign with the Kings. Keandre Miller, who went back for his second year at Wisconsin, but he also signed with the Rangers after the season. And, you know, he had set as his goal to sign at the end of the season, and he really wanted to do that. But, you know, I think there's room for him to learn and get stronger. Like, he's going to need to put on some muscle to be able to compete in the NHL. But I think when he gets signed, he's probably going to come straight to the NHL. I'm not saying that he won't go back down to Laval at some point, but I would be shocked if he does not start his career in the NHL. That would be my opinion, but I don't know. It's hard to say, but you know, I think that he will be given every opportunity to do so, because he represents he's a finisher. The Canadians don't have many finishers in their system. He is a very, very, very elite finisher. And so they will do everything in their power to get him. You know, he makes the he seems to be a perfect complement for Kotkaniemi. He's a righty shot. Kotkaniemi's a lefty. Kotkaniemi likes to dish the puck. Caulfield loves one-timing pucks and is an excellent finisher and is truly elite at finding dead areas in the offensive zone. He has just this innate instinct and knack of finding spots to score and doing so undetected, even though he's the best scorer on the team. So, you know, I can't predict for sure what's going to happen so far in the future, but I would think that the Canadiens will be inclined to give him a shot in the NHL before making the determination whether he should go back to the Laval or not.
Yeah, it's very exciting with all like Suzuki and Kotkaniemi and Caulfield, like this bright future for the Habs. I guess we'll have to see, you know, if they could fill these holes, like you said, but it seems like this could be a strong team if they could stay healthy and all the pieces come together. Before I let you go, one question, let's wrap up here. One question we've been asking all of the beat writers in this series is if you had to pick one Montreal Canadian that you expect to be the biggest, like positive surprise next season, someone who will exceed expectations, and then someone who maybe will be the biggest disappointment, we're expecting bigger things than what he'll end up providing, who would your picks be?
Well, see, one guy that I still feel has offense in his game and that a lot of Montreal fans have kind of given up on is Arturi Lehkonen. Second round pick, really high-end chance creation, scoring chance creation, possession numbers, incredibly good defensive player, but just lacks finish around the net. I don't know why, but I really believe in this guy. I really like his game personally. I believe in him, and I think that he's going to figure it out at some point. You know, to say next season, I'm not sure, but at some point, this guy's going to score 25 goals. I'm really sure of it. So that would be my sleeper, I guess. As for the warning sign, I feel like Phil Deneau's position might be precarious on that line. If he's ever taken off that, and Nick Suzuki, like honestly, Nick Suzuki plays a sound two-way game for a rookie. Like he will eventually grow into a player who can play against those top lines and be responsible and do a lot of the things that Philip Deneau does, but with more offensive upside as a high-skilled player. So I would say that Philip Deneau risks changing roles. And so if there's one guy who might wind up being a disappointment production-wise, it might be him, and he might settle into more of a traditional checking line center role.
Right, and then he loses that 50-point upside he has.
That's it.
Tatar and Gallagher. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, Arpon, thank you so much for all the time you gave us. Like, I feel like I could just keep talking to you about the Habs. It's such a fun team to talk about, and it's been a pleasure talking to you. Is there, obviously people should be following you at Arpon Basu on Twitter and read your articles on The Athletic. Is there anything else you want to tell people to take a look at before I let you go?
Well, I just, you know, if you haven't subscribed to The Athletic, you can go to theathletic.com/athletic support, which is the name of my podcast that I do with Marc-Antoine Godin. But that is sort of a promo code that gets you 40% off your first year at The Athletic. So if you do want to come over and read, you can get 40% off your first year with that promo code, theathletic.com/athletic support.
Cool. Okay. I'll link to that also in our show notes.
Awesome.
So thanks so much again for coming. Have a great rest of your night. And according to this article I read recently by you, I'm hoping the Habs don't make it to this 24 team thing so they can be ready for next
season. Hopefully they get their heads on right and just make it a 20 team thing. Cause that's the model that makes the most sense, but we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I'm sure it'd be exciting for Canadiens fans to have something to root for and the possibility of something, but they'd probably be happier with the 8th overall pick at the draft.
I just would be happy to have like 1 week of hockey action just so I could settle my fantasy leagues. Like, be like, okay, this is the final playoffs. Whoever has the most points wins. And then I don't have to live in purgatory like we are.
That's right. Yeah. I hadn't even thought of that. I'm not a fantasy guy. So, yeah, there must be like so many people like just dying to see what happens at the end of their season.
Yeah. Most of the leagues we've been running for the podcast are in the semifinals right now. So I just need two weeks. Do great. The semis, do the finals. And then, you know, whatever happens in the NHL, you know, they could figure that out. They could have the COVID cup, as Matthew Shane called it on Twitter.
Right. Jeez.
All right. Thanks so much again, Arpon. Have a great rest of your night.
Okay. Thanks, Lan, for having me.
Thank you so much again to Arpon Basu for joining me to talk Habs for this past hour. I had a blast, and I hope you did as well. Would love to hear from you. If you like the show, tweet at us @KeepingCarlson. Let us know what you think. I'm going to tweet out this episode probably it's the tweet is already out tagging myself and Arpad Basu. Let us both know what you thought of the show. I'm sure the beat writers that we interview would love to hear your kind words. And of course, if you haven't noticed, most of the beat writers we've been interviewing are from The Athletic, because that's the source of some of the greatest hockey journalists out there. So yeah, check out athletic.com/athletic support to support Arpad and the other beat writers' work. And no, they're not a paid sponsor, but I really like having access to this great site and all these interesting articles. If you want to support our podcast for only $1 a month, so basically nothing, just basically to show us that, hey, I'm here and I like the show, we'd love for you to sign up and become a patron of Keeping Carlson over at keepingcarlson.com/patron. You get to feel good that you're supporting these 8 interviews a month that we're dropping. And also you could join our Facebook group, and we have like our monthly patron cast and some other perks. So check it out, keepingcarlson.com/patron. They also wouldn't mind a 5-star review on iTunes, but I think I've asked for enough. So let's cue the outro music, and I'm going to go ahead and read you the credits. And here they are. This episode of the Keeping Carlson Fantasy Hockey Podcast was presented by Dauber Hockey and supported by our patrons. Logo art by Brandon Weeb. Outro music by Pat Roach. And it was researched with help from Dauber Hockey's Frozen Tools, Hockey Reference, The Athletic, and of course, mainly the analytical mind of Arpad Basu. That's at Arpad Basu on Twitter. That's all I got. New Jersey Devils are coming next. And until we get there, keep on keeping Carlson.